The shopping mall changed our behavior, our cities, and even our culture. But the era of the shopping mall is over. Today, how our shopping behavior has evolved and how that affects our economy and our communities. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, shopping. Small-town stores have become an endangered species in the past 35 years. I'll talk with the owner of a small-town general store in Bussey. Then economist Dave Swenson will be here to crunch the numbers. We'll find out how our shopping behavior affects the economy. Then I'll talk with Brooke Bemler, mayor of Hampton, about shop local campaigns, and we'll explore the rise and fall of the shopping mall. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. In the 70s and 80s, shopping malls were new and exciting. They brought new businesses and entertainment to town, but often hurt downtown stores. Then came the big box stores, then online shopping, and later on, a renewed push to get people to shop local. This hour, our shopping behavior and the far-reaching effects of the choices that we make. We're going to start in small-town Iowa. And my first guest today runs a grocery store in Bussey. The store is endangered not just because of the challenges facing all small-town stores, but also because of a run of very difficult circumstances for the family that owns Katie Dids. Candy Evans is the proprietor now, and she is with me. Hello, Candy.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Now, first, tell me about Katie Dids, because this is, it's an unusual store. I had a hard time deciding to call it a grocery store as opposed to a general store. So tell me a little bit about your store.
We have a little bit of everything. We have some hardware. We have beer, liquor, groceries, lottery tickets, cigarettes. We do a little bit of everything. We are centrally located in the middle of several small communities, and small, I mean 300 to 500 people, and that's the size of Bussey also. Outlying that is a larger community of Knoxville, Pella, Albia, and Oskaloosa. And so we save people, you know, a half-hour drive time, typically. They can come here and get their milk and bread or, you know, whatever they need. If they're needing some Band-Aids or some cough syrup, they're needing some nuts and bolts, they can come here for their weekend projects also, and it saves them some drive time. We've been in business for 30-plus years. It's been a family-owned business since 1997 when my mom took it over after working here for 20 years. She took it over and then left it to me when she died in 2012. So we're hoping to pass it on to the next generation.
Now, during the time before your mom owned the store, but when she was working there, you know, Iowa went through the farm crisis and we saw a huge shift in small town life in Iowa. A lot of small towns like the ones you're describing, and I'm sure the ones around Bussey and probably including Bussey, lost a lot of their local businesses. Why do you think Katie Dids survived?
Part of it is the community. We are a very close-knit community, and, you know, we're a little family, and we try to support each other. And we've always had that support with this business. We have a very loyal customer base, and I think that's probably what, you know, helped pull us through.
Now, Kyle Munson recently did a wonderful profile of you and your store in the Des Moines Register. And one of the things that really struck me in that article is that your store is more than a store. It is really a community center in many ways in Bussey. Are there other community centers in Bussey, or are you kind of it?
There is a couple other businesses in town. We do have an actual community center, City Hall, that serves senior meals and stuff like that. And then Wilson's Corner is a little gas station sub pizza shop. And, you know, they have their morning coffee drinkers. So, you know, we do have gathering spots, but Katie Dids is kind of the place where, you know, you come in and you show off your prom dress before prom, and you come in and bring your babies in when they're on their way home and show them off. And, you know, you kind of, it's just one of those places where you kind of have to go and tell your news to.
As a business owner in a small town with an unusual business structure, you've worked really hard to create a profitable business. What are some of the decisions you've had to make to remain a going concern? And not talking about the recent challenges you've had with the Department of Human Services, and we'll talk about that in a moment, but how have you had to change your business to keep it relevant, to keep it going?
I've had to learn exactly what the community needs. If they're needing a certain kind of nuts and bolts, or if they're needing, you know, specific groceries, I had to learn, you know, what is going to sell and what isn't, what's relative to the community. There's some things that, you know, just don't go very good in here. And there's other things that, you know, you wouldn't think people would need, but they do.
Can you give me an example of something you wouldn't think would sell, but does?
We have a hard time keeping wax rings in for your toilet bowl.
A great
that
weekend
is a
project,
item that
right?
Katie did.
Now, as you mentioned earlier, your mom passed away in 2012, and along with the difficulty of losing her, you are also now faced with a debt of $90,000 that the Iowa Department of Human Services is trying to collect from your mother's estate. And I know you've worked so hard to create a business that works, and now you're faced with this. Is this something that could put you out of business?
It is. The business itself is not subject to the lawsuit, but the building is still in my mom's name. I guess we just didn't consider it not being part of the business when we transferred the business. And so they can actually sell my building and put me out of business. It's kind of a looming thing. It's been looming for a while. But it's kind of come to a head and we're running out of time. But, you know, the community found out about it and they rallied to support us. And, you know, I think we can beat this. I think we can, you know, we've got enough support financially and publicly that, you know, we've got the right people talking to the right people now. So I'm hoping that we can, you know, get someplace real soon.
I know that there's a GoFundMe campaign that's raised a little over $3,000. And you've also tried to do other fundraising activities as well. Can you tell me about some of the things that you've done to try to raise this money?
We had Lucas Beebe. He's a local artist here in town, and he is just phenomenal, very popular locally. Hopefully he takes off real soon, but he offered to play for a benefit at the local bar here in town. And we was able to raise $2,000 that night. We've also did a can drive, and they're still counting those cans, but we had a mountain of cans for the can drive. So we're not sure how much we made off that yet, but we're waiting to hear that news. And just people coming in and supporting us with cash donations or donations for we're having another benefit on March 20th, and we're getting silent auction donations for that. And we got some really good items for the silent auction. Slumberland has donated a bed and a recliner. We got gift certificates for hotels. We got, you know, odds and ends and really good stuff to, you know, auction off for that. But so far, to date, we've raised over $13,000.
And to stop the building getting sold, how much do you need to raise? I know that the overall debt is $90,000, but how far do you need to get to stop this process?
To come up with the full $90,000, we would need, you know, another $40,000 to $50,000. Right now, the auctioneer has actually reached out and contacted me and offered me a cash bid option. He had me put a cash bid on all three properties, and he's going to try to talk on our behalf with the courts to try to get them to accept that cash bid offer. That could save us $40,000.
Candy, as people have really rallied together to try to save your store. What have you learned about what Katie did means to Bussey and the surrounding towns?
You know, it's amazing. I knew, you know, I was loved in this town. I knew my mom was loved in this town, and I knew, you know, people appreciated having the store and the convenience of the store here. But it has just floored me with the amount of support and love that has just, you know, come out of the woodwork and, you know, gone out of their way to show me just how much, you know, having this store means to them and their community.
If Katie Dids went out of business, obviously that would be a hardship for you. You also have how many employees at the store?
Right now I have 4 part-time employees and 1 on maternity leave.
All right. And you mentioned earlier that by carrying all of these different products, having such a variety of things, you're often saving people at least a half an hour journey.
Yeah.
What else do you think Bussey would lose if it lost Katie Dids?
Financial support. I like to contribute back to my community. I donate to the school and I donate to, you know, local causes. I try to support as many as I can when I'm asked. That and taxes, you know, we do, you know, pay our taxes and, you know, support the economy. And just a social spot. You know, these small towns need a gathering place to come together and to share news and to share gossip, to be there for one another. I don't think Bussey would be the same, you know, without this business to, you know, have support it.
You need a place to bring your new baby so everybody can
you
see
do.
The baby and to wear the prom dress and to share news about the
yes.
community. Well, Candy, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. And I certainly hope things go your way. And Katie Dids remains at the heart of Bussey for many more years.
Okay. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Candy Evans is the proprietor of Katie Dids in Bussey. It's a small town grocery store, general store, hardware store. And we, this hour, are talking about many different kinds of stores and our shopping behavior over the years. These small town stores became endangered many years ago in Iowa because of the farm crisis, but also because of a shift in how we shop. We'll talk about shopping malls and box stores and online shopping. We'll also explore how these behaviors affect the economics of our state and our towns and how they affect our communities and our longevity. That's coming up in just a moment. We'd love to hear from you as well with your thoughts and your experiences and how your shopping behavior has changed over the years. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about shopping and how our shopping decisions, our shopping behavior have affected our economy and our communities around the state of Iowa. We'd love to hear from you this hour. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And joining me now is Dave Swenson. He's an associate professor of economics at Iowa State University. Hello, Dave.
Hello, good morning. And it's associate scientist, not professor.
Pardon me.
That's okay.
Let me start with a little bit of history. Of course, we know the quintessential small town or towns in Iowa. We think about these downtown retail centers, and people didn't travel that far to go shopping historically. When did things really start to change, and how did they change?
Well, you already introduced it. It was during the farm crisis. Actually, it had started to change earlier, but it was accelerated during the farm crisis. And we need to think of all the things that were going on at that time. We had a farm crisis. We had a massive change in agriculture. We also had technology changes going on in rural areas where the labor needs locally, whether it's in support of directly in support of agriculture or agriculture support industries. Those were changing. We were moving more towards mechanization, more towards chemicals. And we had labor that had to go find someplace else to work. We also had more people within a household, especially during the farm economy, starting to participate in the workforce. And they tended not to participate locally. They participated in the next larger or largest town. And so we got more and more travel. And added to that is a higher and higher probability that people who had been primarily farmers were now part-time farmers, and again, were also working in another place. So mobility changed, our spatial orientation changed, more people working in the workforce changed, and then you mentioned it, the farm crisis. Iowa's population declined by 4.3% during the decade of the 1980s, and it took us another decade to recover those people. Most of that loss was out in Iowa's rural space. So all of those factors combined to shift shopping and retail potency away from small self-contained communities that had hardware stores and clothing stores and shoe stores and lumber yards and grocery stores. And over time, that shifted to the next larger economy. Maybe Coon Rapids might have been, you know, exactly as I just described, having all of those stores in 1975. By 1980 or by 1990, most of that retail activity may have shifted to a place like Carroll, just to the north. And that's the kind of pattern that repeated itself over and over and over again in Iowa. Small town, self-contained retail activity became less and less viable, and it shifted. We also had at the same time, of course, the advent of large general merchandising stores. You might have remembered, well, we used to have smaller ones, but of course, Walmart. And Walmart came in not in the metropolitan areas back then. Walmart showed up in the medium to slightly larger kinds of cities. And they also captured a lot of that change that was going on in Iowa's demographics and Iowa's economy. So we had this dynamic pattern that really, really worked its way through all the way through the 80s into the 1990s.
Well, and we're going to talk in more detail about the shopping mall later in the hour, but the shopping mall also played a part in this because I grew up in Cedar Falls, Iowa, and when I was a kid in the 1980s, the mall was really the center of commerce, and our downtown was really hollow. So even within the larger communities that were not as affected by the farm crisis, we saw that shift, right?
Oh, of course we did. And that started in the 1970s, again, into the 80s, the whole mall phenomenon, the building of malls. Those malls were always going to be placed, or almost always going to be placed, on the edge of a community, near transportation nodes, easy ingress, easy access. And that came at the expense, obviously, of a traditional downtown. The malls have gone through cycles as well, where we've seen over time malls that were built in the 70s and 80s are now derelict and they've been replaced by newer malls or newer configurations. So it's a continuous process of retail trade preference and transformation. We see now, for example, in and around metropolitan areas, not huge malls, although we did get a new one with Jordan Creek a few years ago. What we get are these little crossroads combinations of shopping centers. So the retail industry is forever trying to capture, it's trying to capture the intersection between where mobility is occurring and where's that intersection, as well as affluence. And that's why you tend to see the retail growth always spreading out into suburban areas.
Well, and it's interesting, and I'm going to, because of course I've observed it closely, but I'm going to continue with talking about Cedar Falls. So when I was a kid, the downtown was empty and the mall was thriving. Now the mall is empty and there is, on the south side of town, just as you described, expansion of all of these different stores. Many of them used to be in the mall. They are no longer. At the same time, there's been a huge push in that community and so many other communities to rebuild the downtown. So now there are these two shopping districts, the downtown shopping district and then the one on the outskirts of town with this sort of derelict mall in what is now kind of the center of town, even though it used to be on the edge. Is that a pattern where we see in a lot of different communities?
It sure is. And you can take it down into even smaller communities. And governments and communities have, to a degree, enabled some of this. We've underwritten this development of retail activity out on the edge of town. We might have used tax breaks to do this. And oftentimes, it's a zero-sum game. It's very important to understand retail serves us locally. So if something big goes up in one spot, most of those sales are going to come from all other retailers within the community. They're not, it's just because you have something big come in doesn't mean the entire regional economy is going to grow. As a matter of fact, the odds are likely that it's not going to grow. You're really only in competition locally. So these kinds of changes and patterns are going on in a lot of places. We've seen, for example, because so many people commute out of some of our, even our medium-sized communities, you'll see strip malls or other kinds of configurations, Hy-Vees and Walmarts, they're all on the highway into and out of town. The main place going place in and out. And the shopping that is going on there more or less comes at the expense of what would have been a historic downtown. And so we have downtowns struggling, downtowns trying to find a new identity, trying to wrestle with, and I know a little bit about your Cedar Falls, and what you end up with is specialty or niche shopping oftentimes in the historic downtown, plus dining and drinking and trying to make it a place where people want to visit, especially in the evening, because they can't they can offer something that's a little bit different and unique and again, as I said, a niche versus the general mall experience or the big box experience that you get on the edge of town.
What does that hollow center do to a community, whether it was the downtown's hollowing out or now the mall's hollowing out? What are the effects of that?
Well, the effects of that are a general degradation of the community's value. Yes, you have a growth out on the fringe, but you're abandoning, and because you're abandoning it, the value of that goes down, the property tax values go down, the rent values go down. It creates the conditions for disinvestment and blight. And this is, well, suburbanization in the whole is one of the great explainers, of course, of urban blight. And so it is something that communities need to worry about. You need to effectively utilize the space that you have and try to reinvigorate. I can name, you know, a dozen cities that are just struggling. They're medium-sized. They maybe have 10,000 or 12 or 14,000 people trying to figure out a way to make their downtown viable and vibrant. And it's a heck of a problem from small cities all the way to large cities.
I'm talking with Dave Swenson. He's an associate scientist in the Department of Economics and the College of Agriculture at Iowa State University. We're talking about shopping this hour, our shopping behavior and the impact of our behavior and how things have evolved over time. And we were just talking about how downtowns kind of became hollow in many communities. And then there was this resurgence, a push to make sure that the downtown had things that could attract local people and maybe even some people from out of town. So we're going to talk about shop local campaigns here for a few minutes. And joining us is Brooke Bemler. He's mayor of Hampton and director of the Small Business Development Center of North Iowa. And a few years ago, he was also at the head of a very unique shop local campaign. Hello, Brooke.
Good morning.
Thanks you.
For having
yeah,
me.
Thank you so much for being here. And I want to go back and just in a thumbnail description, let's talk about your Buy One Product Local campaign, which really got a lot of people's attention.
Yeah, it was something that we had a committee. We have a lot of great industries here in our community, Sika Manufacturing and ABCM Corporation. Both of their marketing departments was on our chamber, and it takes a lot of people involved. And at that time, we wanted to come up with a campaign that basically would focus on all the good things we have in our community. And Dr. Swenson was talking about specialty shops and what do you have. We're a small community of about 5,000 people, but we're also a county seat in what we call Greater Franklin County, which encompasses about 15,000 people. So if you go to a metropolitan area, we have about 15,000, but our town is 5,000. And we said, what product could help us explain what the impact of shopping local was about. And we came up with what if a whole community committed to only buying one product locally? And that one product was toilet paper. And that was our toilet paper campaign. And we had done some research of with Kimberly Clark had helped us, and they said an average person uses 105 rolls of paper, toilet paper, per year. And with that, we should have sold 1.5 million rolls of toilet paper. And at the average price of a roll of toilet paper, we should have been selling $1.9 million worth of toilet paper. Well, we don't have a Walmart. We don't have a lot of other things. We've got a Come and Go. We've got a Fairway. We've got a Shopko. It was pretty easy to find out and get some estimates of how much toilet paper we had been selling on an annual basis. And we had only been selling around $335,000. We had lost $1.6 million just in toilet paper. Now, granted, there's lost leaders, all those things. And it was a lot of fun to make fun of one community committed to buying their toilet paper local. And a lot of people were saying, oh, we need to track how we can buy more. That was not the issue. The issue we wanted to do is point out, where are you buying? Now, you know, how do you beat a Walmart? And a lot of people are going to super centers and outside our community to buy certain things. But it let us focus on what we were missing in our community and what could you be buying locally. And it let us focus on some of the things that what we don't have and why aren't we having it. And since then, two of the things that have come out of this, I mean, we have a local brew pub, tap room. We have numerous Hispanics. We have a high Hispanic population here. We are known for 4 grocery stores of Hispanic products. And if you need specialty, and that's where I think the key thing is specialty shopping, we have exaggerated. You want to come to Hampton, Iowa, you will see specialty shops that know and work together almost like in a mall sense. But we are also a Main Street district. We've been a Main Street community for over 25 years, and Jim Thompson at the Main Street has always helped us with our numbers. Or what are we missing? What product leakage are we losing to other communities? And not that we want a Walmart, but yet in the same way, what about a car dealership? What about making sure our downtown, our Windsor Theater, a nonprofit, could be doing plays? And we've been doing another thing. We have become like North Central Iowa's. We have a hoedown in our local theater that we draw around 300 people, and of that, over 200 of them are outside our county coming to play in a hoedown in a Texas-style jam of bluegrass music every Monday night. And it's like, there wasn't anything else. The theater was closed. We're trying to use our assets, our downtown assets, to continue to bring people in.
And to return to that campaign that you did, I mean, focusing on toilet paper really, really captured a lot of people's attention and a lot of people's imagination. Do you feel like it changed people's behavior in Hampton? Do you think people did become more thoughtful about where they were buying some of their very simple products?
It was kind of funny because most of the people were saying, you know, when I'm in a superstore or something like that, of course, that's where I go to buy my toilet paper. But also in buying other things that I could be buying locally. And I think the more people look and get ahead of what they're buying and why they're buying it, the better chance we have of getting that dollar back in our small town communities. It also gave us a quality of life issue. I mean, how many of those super stores and that stuff are contributing to our Quarry Leagues and contributing to our downtown festivals? That's the key thing. It's quality of life issues. And we don't have to apologize for having a great place to raise your family and enjoy your life. And in North Central Iowa, all we're talking about is we need more people. When we see Des Moines growing and more of the metropolitan areas growing, and yet the rural, and I think Dr. Schwentz was talking about that, we haven't got those people back. And we want them to come back to our communities. We want them to buy grandma and grandpa's house or grandma and grandpa or our parents' stores. And I sit and work in 9 counties trying to make sure that people realize that you just don't have to close your store. We could try to sell it and make succession planning. We work so hard on farms in the farming community that people, you know, make sure there's a great succession plan to keep the farming operation. But we don't spend that much time with our small retailers. And that's the part that it's sad when you see a retail store close because they didn't realize that someone may have wanted it.
Help us look into the future. Do you feel like we've turned a corner for small town businesses, for small town retail in Iowa?
Well, I think as Dr. Swanson was talking about, the issue of when do you want to buy? Do you want to buy at the high or do you want to buy at the low? And I think most of our communities in our urban agricultural communities, now's the time to come in. People are wanting to come back. They want to get out of the bigger cities. And the prices, I mean, per square foot for a house here is phenomenal. And, you know, so gas is cheaper. If you want to commute to Mason City or Ames or Cedar Falls, this is the community you want to live in. You can't, our educational system is phenomenal here because we are one of the few counties that is continuing to grow because of our labor pool. We have a great story to tell here in Franklin County and Hampton, Iowa.
Well, Mayor Bemler, Hampton is really fortunate to have an advocate like you. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Mayor Brooke Bemler of Hampton. He's also director of the Small Business Development Center in North Iowa. We're going to take a break here in just a moment. I'm also talking with Dave Swenson. He's an associate scientist in the Department of Economics and the College of Agriculture at Iowa State University. And Dave, in just a moment, I want to get your take on shop local campaigns and the impact of people shopping locally in the community. We'll take a break before we get to that. We also want to hear from you, your thoughts this hour. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And shopping malls did really shape our culture for a while. They seem to be on the decline. We will explore the rise and fall of the shopping mall as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about shopping and how our shopping behavior has evolved, how our behavior, our choices affect the economy and our communities. With me is Dave Swenson, associate scientist in the Department of Economics and the College of Agriculture at Iowa State University. And Dave, just before the break, we were focusing on shop local campaigns and the possible power of those campaigns. And as people shifted toward online shopping and shifted toward going perhaps to outlet malls and driving farther to shop, a lot of communities have created these shop local campaigns. From your perspective, what can the impact be?
Well, the impact can be substantial. What I try to advise people, and I've done several studies on buy local initiatives. I've done them for large cities, and I've done them for medium and small cities. And the whole point of shop local isn't just to buy your retail goods local. It's the whole scope of purchasing behavior that goes on in your community. And in an average county, more than half of the purchasing behavior that goes on in that community is business to business or business opportunities, buying, procuring goods or services just to run their business. So it's not just households. So we look at two dimensions. What can we do? They look at two dimensions. How do you entice businesses to buy from one another? And then the other dimension is how do you entice households to reconfigure their thinking and think about buying locally? So I've done economic impact studies because, and this is very, very important to understand, there is a multiplier effect. It's not very high, but it's a multiplier effect. For every dollar of sales that occurs outside of your community that you shift, whether it's to the next city or whether it's to an online sale, it has a value greater than that dollar in your local community. Flip it around, though, if you can begin to recapture or if you can prevent a leakage of sales, that has a beneficial multiplier effect regionally. Let's say it's 1.3. For every dollar you're able to capture locally, it supports another 30 cents worth of economic activity in the regional economy. So you can see that ratio is beneficial. If you're able to recapture it, it's harmful if you lose it. Well, that's the effort here. And so what the communities will oftentimes try to do, and they try to begin with a very, very modest approach. What would it be worth to our economy if we were to recapture 5% of our lost sales? And I can measure that using a statistical model, and we can figure out what a recapture of 5% would be across all business procurement categories, all household spending for retail goods and services and everything like that. And then we can come up with an economic impact. And then the people that we do this for then will say, okay, this is what our economy would grow by, or this is what it's worth to our economy if you just shop locally. And so that's the nature of it. How well they've been able to implement it, I always tell people that I can't tell, given the tools that I have, whether you're successful, unless you let me survey everybody and I track them all the way through this. And I haven't got time and nobody's going to pay for that. The most important part of this is that it creates an opportunity for leadership and engagement in a community around exactly what the mayor was just talking about, around the whole idea of saying buying from one another helps one another. My income is my sales to you. Your income is your sales to me. And we have a mutually beneficial relationship that we need to support.
Let's talk about the idea of buying local, because in some people's minds, buying local means buying from locally owned businesses. In other people's minds, it may mean buying things in person in my community as opposed to shopping online. So let's say I go to a big box store or one of these big buyers clubs. That's where I buy my toilet paper. That's where I buy my other products. Is that benefiting my community, even though that is not a mom and pop shop?
Yeah, I try to be careful with this. See, we're getting into the value judgment territory. And it could be that your sister's working in that store, and were it not for you shopping at that store, your sister wouldn't have a job. We need it. When people think about it, they think buy local from local proprietors, and that there is a little bit more benefit because the local people have more investment, reasons to reinvest in the community. Those are all fine and good. And yes, there may be a bump to that economic impact if you buy from locally owned versus just local. But the research that I do can't sort that out. And what we really just care about is how many dollars can you keep in a community for just one more day?
And how big is the effect of online shopping in our communities? Because it's incredibly convenient.
It is. It's grown quite a lot nationally. There's various measurements, but if you just go back 5 years, it was around 4% or so of all retail sales. Now it's grown to about 7.5%, maybe closer to 8% now of all retail sales. So it's creeping into everybody's sales. It's creeping into state sales tax collections. It's creeping into communities' opportunities. It actually creates even easier opportunities for rural shoppers to not shop locally and to not have to put up with a drive 30 miles or 15 miles to the next big box store. So it is having an impact on retail activity, and of course it has an impact on the state's economy as a whole. We're not a state that's a major supplier of online goods. So most of our online retail activity, that's just money that leaves the state.
All right. Although there are delivery drivers that are kept pretty busy and some other smaller impacts, right?
Yeah, they're much smaller.
All right. I want to get to the phones quickly, and then we're going to bring another guest in the conversation. But Jay is on the line in Perry. Hi, Jay.
Hello, how are you?
Very good. And this is a subject very close to your heart. You own two stores in Perry and Panora?
That is correct.
And what has your experience been? You're also the mayor of Perry. So what has your experience
That's
been with stores in those smaller communities?
And that happened over time. I might preface this with my wife's family. If you go back to her grandfather and grandmother, they got into a business, and they were basically buying little Ben Franklin stores. And what they would do is go into a town, fix up a store that was failing, and then sell the store and move on to another store. So Jan's mom literally grew up in the back rooms of these little stores all over Iowa because they would continue to fix them up and move. And sometimes they literally did live in the back room of the store for a while until they got established in the community. Her parents went on to run a popular store in Adel that was called the Ben Franklin Store. It's no longer there now, But at one time, her dad owned five of these stores across Iowa. And we purchased the store in Perry in 1980. And what's curious about that is that these stores peaked in 1978, as Dave was talking about earlier in your conversation. And then the farm crisis came on the tail of that. The one thing that I will say is during the farm crisis, things did get slow. And so what my wife and I did as owners at that time back then was we took the time that we had on our hands and we expanded our store. So even though it was a rough time, we actually expanded during the farm crisis. And we purchased a second store in 1997. And what's significant about that year was the year that the big corporation, Ben Franklin, that supplied all the stores across the country, these little variety stores, bellied up that year. They went bankrupt. And the result was that we could get fixtures at 10 cents on the dollar. So on the year that we lost our major supplier, we opened a second store.
Huh. Well, Jay, we're almost out of time. But let me ask you, today in Perry and Panora, what do you think the role is of these little stores?
You know, they fill a niche in, and they also fill a nostalgia. There's appeal to these stores because of nostalgia, and we have people that drive a distance, actually, to come to our stores, so it's the reverse effect. And what they're saying is, oh, I haven't been in a store like this in years. This is so wonderful. But we do also provide to the local community a wide selection of items. And so many of the larger stores, their sales are based on number of turns in a year. And if they don't have so many turns, they eliminate the item. What we hear constantly is, we've looked everywhere for this and couldn't find it, and here it is.
Well, Jay, thank you so much for calling and sharing your story with us today. And I want to bring Richard Feinberg into the conversation now. He's a professor of retail management and head of the Department of Consumer Science at Purdue University. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. And I've mentioned it many times this hour. We saw the rise of the shopping mall in the 70s and 80s. It became a very significant part of our culture. And then the decline of the shopping mall has been incredibly dramatic. What happened to the mall? Why are they so much in decline?
Well, I would just simply say that the death of the mall is way overstated. The mall is still a very significant place for people to go, and people are still going to the malls to get out of the weather, to have fun, to meet people, to have a pretzel, to spend some time that doesn't cost money, to go to the movies. So the malls are not dead, and they're learning how to reposition themselves to become more central part of a community activity and consumers' activity.
How are you seeing malls change to remain relevant? Because we certainly see a lot of empty malls in Iowa and all over the country.
Well, they're becoming more lifestyle centers. So they're integrating housing with services with shopping in a cheaper way to do business. The problem with enclosed malls has been the tremendous expense for building them and then for keeping them up, particularly as they get older, it becomes more expensive. As they become more expensive, the developers have to charge bigger rents. As they charge bigger rents, it gets harder for the retailers who are in there to survive. And they have also fell victim to what used to be their largest draws, the JCPenney's, the Sears, these very large chains that have run into significant problems. And now you have these big empty spaces with no big retailers to fill them.
Now, as a lot of these malls have struggled, we were just talking about the rise of online shopping. Are there other changes in our behavior that have made it hard for malls to stay in business?
Well, the big issue is the internet is the largest mall in the world. It's the largest store in your area. It's the largest mall in your area, and consumers who now have complete access to broadband connections and have experienced shopping, they do not look at shopping online as any different than going to the mall or going to the store. It's a matter of convenience. It's a matter of selection. It's a matter of price. And for many of us, it's just less friction to do it online. The Google is the greatest personal assistant than any of us have. And stores have not caught up with their understanding of how much friction there is in shopping in the local area, in the local stores. And so they have to, you know, the internet is not only important for selling things. You don't have to sell anything on the internet to make it a very important strategic weapon in your business, a small business or a large business. Every store should have a compelling internet site, even if they don't sell anything. Our research at Purdue shows that 75% of consumers under the age of 65 are doing research on a website before they go into a store. And so if you don't have a compelling website, they may not think of going to your store.
What do you think the future of malls is?
I don't think malls are going away. I think malls are going to have to become more of a center of entertainment and community activity, as they were designed to be at the very beginning, instead of just a place to do transactions. And so we have consumers are now in the habit of simply going to one or two stores and doing their transactions and leaving, instead of walking around and having a pretzel or an ice cream or whatever else they want to eat and meeting their friends there. And so malls are going to have to do more of that lifestyle stuff.
Richard, thank you so much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
Richard Feinberg, professor of retail management and head of the Department of Consumer Science at Purdue. And Dave, all right, in Iowa, as I mentioned, we see a lot of empty malls in communities, a lot of towns trying to figure out how to reinvent the mall. What do you see growing in Iowa right now? We talked about those stores getting built on the edge of town. What else is there that seems to be up and coming at the moment?
Well, we have several layers of things that are growing. What we've seen out in some of the smaller communities, think about 5,000 to about 10,000, we've seen those communities be able to stabilize and hold on to their regional sales. They get Shopcos, they get Dollar Values, maybe they have a Walmart. But the point is that we're seeing a lot of stability that we hadn't seen in previous decades. So over the last 5 years, we see some stability out in rural areas. In newer places, what we observe is, again, while we talked about the mall and he says malls aren't dead, and obviously malls aren't dead because people still go to them, we know that malls are being repurposed. But what we do see are what they call power centers, or these strips of lots of big box stores in strategic locations. So less of a mall focus and much more of a combination of stores and restaurants and a mix of shopping opportunities that aren't all contained within one building. That's where most of the suburban kind of growth is going on, not just in Iowa, but any other places that are growing. That's what you see. So for the most part, our retail experience and growth is still tied to the dynamics of suburbanization and urbanization.
How about outlet malls? That's something that we saw a lot of pop up. We're still seeing a few built in Iowa. I think there was one just announced in Altoona not very long ago. Is that something that we're going to continue to see?
Well, I don't know, but I'm kind of skeptical. We've had outlet malls, and outlet malls tend to go through a boom and bust. And for example, we had the Tanger Outlet Mall that was in Iowa County, just west of Iowa City. And I've got a graph up here, and it just shows that there was a tremendous increase in their share of the state's retail trade activity, and it lasted about 8 years, and then Coralville came in, and then it dropped back down. We had one here north of Ames. Again, for a while, it was doing quite well. But the market, when it sees somebody doing well, attacks. And so that's what happens, and these kinds of things oftentimes just don't have the perceived or the as big a real impact over time as the perceived impact.
It sounds to me, my main takeaway from the hour is, if you care about the economy of your community, you want to play a part in it, you need to shop there.
That's true.
All right, Dave, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're welcome.
Dave Swenson is an associate scientist in the Department of Economics and the College of Agriculture at Iowa State University. We've been talking about shopping this hour on Talk of Iowa. The show is produced by Claire Roth, Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. You can email us anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter at IPR Talk. You can also follow me on Twitter at Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.